We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Yeah, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm filling in once again for Steve, who is out of town. And our guest for this hour is Mr. Matthew Sorens, who serves as the U.S. Church Training Specialist for World Relief, where he helps churches to understand immigration issues from a biblical perspective. Are you with us, Matthew?
I am. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. Mr. Sorens has authored a book entitled Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, along with a co-author, Jenny Huang, who also works with World Relief as Director of Advocacy and Policy of the Refugee and Immigration Program. Have I got all that right?
Yeah, it's a pretty long title, but that's right.
Yeah, well, thank you. Welcome to the program.
It's a privilege to be here with you.
We're talking with you in large part because you will be coming to Champaign-Urbana next weekend. Is that right?
That is right. I'm very excited. I'll be there next Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Champaign Public Library.
Right.
In an event that's sponsored by the First Mennonite Church and a few other churches as well.
Right. The forum is entitled The Immigration Debate, Truth, Compassion, and Justice. It'll be held starting the day before you just mentioned, next Saturday, October 22nd, starting at 1 p.m. at the First Mennonite Church, which is located at 1902 West Springfield Avenue in Urbana. And then it continues on Sunday at the Champaign Public Library at 200 West Green. And I understand that you, Mr. Sorens, will be the featured speaker on Sunday from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Have I got that right?
That's what I've been told, too. So I'm looking forward to being there.
The title of your talk this coming Sunday is the same as your book, which was published in 2009, Welcoming the Stranger. I wonder if you wouldn't, I'm not sure you've done this several times before, but please give our listeners a brief synopsis of the focus of your talk.
Sure. Well, the title comes from the Bible, from the book of Matthew, 25th chapter of Matthew, where Jesus explains to his disciples, he said, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me in. And Jesus, the disciples say to Jesus, well, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger? And they continue. And he says, well, whatever you did to one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did unto me. And so we've, you know, built, starting with that passage and then looking through the scriptures, really the theme of the book and also of the talk I'll be giving next week is to try to think, especially for those of us who are Christians, and that's my background, how do we think about this controversial, complex issue of immigration to the United States? How do we extend that hospitality that Scripture makes clear not only in Matthew 25, but in many other passages that people who follow after Jesus are supposed to extend to those who are strangers, who are immigrants? At the same time, you know, this issue gets very controversial very quickly because nearly a third of the foreign-born population in the United States is here unlawfully. And we also have biblical principles that call us to obey the law. So I think a lot of Christians feel a tension there, and a lot of other people in our society as well, between wanting to both, you know, show love and compassion, but also, you know, to respect the rule of law. And I think that's a struggle that a lot of people in our society feel, a tension as they think about this issue of immigration. And that's kind of what I'll be discussing on Sunday night, and trying to address that tension and how do we think about this issue of immigration, particularly from a Christian faith perspective, in a way that both extends compassion and honors the rule of law.
Well, we have an hour to have with you on this topic. It's certainly timely and very interesting and deeply perplexing topic, not just for Christian evangelicals for whom you've written your book, Welcoming the Stranger, but really for all people who have a sense of ethics and spirituality and are trying to come to some ethical understanding of how to deal with the immigration issue. So I hope you don't mind if we focus on your book
sure.
with a view towards trying to get people interested in coming to hear you next Sunday.
Of course.
I should mention that this is a call-in show, and if listeners would like to call in with a question or comment, please do so. You can call in locally at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. I should also mention that the other two speakers next Sunday, besides Mr. Sorens, who's on the program this afternoon, are at 1 o'clock. Mr. Saulo Padilla, I hope I pronounced it correctly, from Guatemala. He'll be speaking on the topic of understanding and mending the broken immigration system. Mr. Padilla directs the Office on Immigration Education for the Mennonite Central Committee, and he focuses on education and information on immigration as well as biblical and theological resources related to this topic. And then on Saturday, after Mr. Padilla's talk at 3 p.m. on Saturday, the speaker will be Dean Lennemeyer, who brings 20 years of experience as a pastor in the Midwest. He has worked on economic development in the Democratic Republic of Congo and also in the state of Mississippi. I'd love to ask him sometime how he compares the Congo and the Mississippi, but we'll put that aside. His focus is on how the church can be a safe place for all people. So, Mr. Sorens, why don't you tell us a little bit about your own background? You have been working for this organization, World Relief, for how long?
For about 6 years. So I actually started with World Relief as an intern in our office in Nicaragua, so I was working in a microfinance program. And then I came on staff in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually fresh out of college. And, you know, immigration was not, I didn't necessarily feel like addressing issues of immigration was my calling in life. I mostly needed a job. But it's really been, you know, and I didn't grow up in a context where immigration was particularly on my radar screen. I grew up in Wisconsin in a relatively small town where if we had immigrants, I wasn't aware of them. Pretty homogenous, you know, small city.
And if there is an accent to Wisconsin, you sound like you have one.
We do, yeah. I've tried to unlearn it, but I'm an immigrant from Wisconsin to Illinois, so that's my immigration experience. And it is a bit of a culture shock sometimes.
Well, you're an alien to Illinois, shall
yep.
we say.
you know, this wasn't an issue that really was something I thought about much. And if anything, if I thought anything about immigration, it was based on what I'd seen on television, heard on the radio, and that wasn't always very positive. Depending on what radio you're listening to or what television you're watching, you can hear a lot of pretty scary things about immigrants. And, you know, without any relationships to debunk some of those misconceptions, those were what I believe. But as I, my journey to thinking about this issue really began while I was in college. I spent time in Costa Rica working in a primarily immigrant community in San Jose, Costa Rica, where most of the population are Nicaraguan or their children. And Nicaraguans go to Costa Rica for much the same reason that, you know, Mexicans or Central Americans come to the United States,
right?
Which is there's a much better economic situation. And as I would observe, you know, these people who became my friends, I was, you know, playing soccer with kids and leading Bible studies. And as I got to know some of these Nicaraguan families, some of whom were there lawfully and some of whom were not there lawfully in Costa Rica, I noticed how badly they were treated by many in Costa Rican society, and that they would do very, very difficult jobs for very little pay relative to other people. And I asked some of my friends there as I got to know them, you know, so why would you come here where you're going to get mistreated? Why not just stay where you're at in Nicaragua? And some of them said, well, you know, Matt, you have to understand there's here I've got a job, I've got food on my plate, I'm even able to send some money back to my family in Nicaragua, and and that's all I can ask for. And that really got me thinking as I came back to the U.S. And here to Illinois, I started to notice that we actually have some immigrants here as well. And I didn't know them. I didn't know their stories. But it really challenged me that maybe I should get to know them before I, you know, presumed the worst about them, which is what I tended to do before that trip. And so over the course of several years, I both began working as an immigration counselor at World Relief, which is the humanitarian arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. We're a faith-based group that serves refugees and other immigrants.
How did you hook up with World Relief?
Well, I'd worked with them in Nicaragua, something totally different. So I came back to the Chicago area and saw that they had an office here in the suburbs of Chicago, where I live. And they had a job opening that required someone who speaks Spanish. So by that time, I spoke Spanish fairly well. So I applied for it and was, you know, offered this job. And it was really through that job, as well as through after college, I moved into a neighborhood where most of my neighbors are immigrants. So out of our 120-unit apartment complex, we've got 20 different countries of nationality. And so, of course, many with legal status, but also some without. And I really began to wrestle with this question. If, you know, as a Christian, very central to my faith is the idea that I'm called to love my neighbor. And I really began to wrestle with what does that look like when literally, in my context here, my neighbor is an immigrant from Mexico who doesn't have legal status, single mom. You know, how do I do that effectively? And is, you know, is there an exception if somebody has broken the law? Do I still need to love my neighbor?
Right.
And I really began to wrestle with those questions, to read the Bible with something of a new lens as I tried to figure out, you know, do the Christian scriptures have anything to say to how I would respond to the situation? And so the combination of my work, where I got to know the immigration laws really well as a legal counselor, and then just my day-to-day life in this neighborhood, really forced me to wrestle with some of these questions and some of the theology behind the questions as well.
Well, your book, Welcoming the Stranger, published in 2009, is, I would recommend it not just for Christians and evangelicals for whom you mostly wrote it, because you do work with churches around the country, I assume, but also anyone who's interested in a good scholarly summary of the history of immigration in this country and how we got to where we are. It's quite well researched. I commend you on the quality of the writing.
Thank you. Well, and we, you know, it is most of what's in the book. It is, you know, because I am an evangelical, I particularly wanted to help challenge evangelicals in the way we think about this, but the scriptures we're looking at would be applicable to anyone of a Christian tradition, or many of them are actually from what Christians consider the Old Testament, so anyone from a Jewish background as well. And then much of the book isn't about the Bible, it's about the realities of our immigration system. You know, what is the history? How does the law work? Which, if you're not an immigrant, you've probably never had to know about.
Right.
And then talk about some of the economics behind this issue as well, which, again, can be kind of a cloudy area for a lot of people.
Well, let's just start with the basics. Tell us what your rationale is for dropping the term illegal alien and replacing it with undocumented immigrant.
Sure. Well, of course, they basically mean the same thing in, you know, in the terms that we use it. I guess I'd have to look both at the word illegal and the word alien. Alien, I think, was a perfectly fine word to use 100 years ago to describe an immigrant, someone from another country. But, you know, a lot of people today, when they hear the word alien, their first, you know, the first image in their mind is somebody, is some sort of big green Martian.
Right.
And if there's any word that we could use to dehumanize someone, that might be the best one possible.
Of course, we do have E.T.
We do have E.T. We have, you know, we have Men in Black. We've got all this. We've got Hollywood has given us a nice legacy of what an alien is. And so I don't think that any, you know, some versions of the Bible use that word as well. And there's not an offense intended. But I think for 2011, it's not the most useful word. And it's a word that allows us to forget that, at least from a theological perspective, that this is a person who may have broken some laws, certainly, but who is still made in the image of God, who has an inherent dignity, just on account of being a human being. And we can forget that when we think, you know, when we talk about people in terms that don't recognize their humanity. That's not to turn them into saints or perfect people either, but I think there is this. The word alien is unhelpful in that regard. So an immigrant is perhaps more accurate to the way we use English today. And then there's the term illegal. And we are not in any way denying the fact that people who have who are undocumented, who don't have valid legal status, have, and by definition, broken the law. Sometimes they've broken a criminal code. If they've entered unlawfully, that's a misdemeanor. Very often they've broken a civil code, which is the immigration laws for being unlawfully present. So about half the people who are here undocumented entered legally but overstayed a visa. But in either case, they have broken a law. But that isn't to say that their identity is that of illegal. So illegal should be an adjective, not a noun. So to call someone an illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is most of us have broken a law at one point. I would have to confess that to come into my office to do this in radio interview, I may have exceeded the speed limit by a couple miles an hour.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your book. That's on record, so you should be careful.
I know. I haven't changed since 2009. I haven't reformed my ways. And if anyone has driven in Chicago, you'll find that most people, I'm in good company.
So we don't need to report you. We already know.
But I think, if you want to take that, I guess the question would be, why are people who drive illegally, they might, we don't think of them as illegal drivers, but we would agree that speeding is illegal. I think that's a fair statement to make. I think the problem is when we turn that into someone's identity, it tends to help us, it doesn't help us think of them as human beings.
The term occurs to me, illegal scofflaws.
Yeah.
That's sort of parallel to illegal alien.
Right. And, we tend to think of, you hear illegal, you think of murderers or rapists or thieves. And, while those people are also made in the image of God and have inherent dignity, I think we should be careful. We should look at what the particular offense that someone has committed is, because they're not all offenses are equal. They don't all have the same motivation behind them.
Well, you have a very interesting. I haven't really seen this before. I'm sure there's. When I looked at your bibliography, I was amazed at the scholarship behind this. But why don't you give us a little thumbnail sketch of the history behind how we got to 11 to 12 million? That number.
Sure. Yeah. So the estimates are probably about 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. That's according to the Department of Homeland Security. And of course, people ask me, well, how do they get that number? To be honest, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure that out. But
just so we're clear for our audience, that's what percentage of the overall population?
It's approximately one-third of the overall foreign-born population.
All right.
So of the total immigrant population. So it is also important to mention, I think sometimes people hear the word immigrant and they think illegal, and that's not a fair association.
Right.
Because the average immigrant is here lawfully. But there are, we also can't talk about immigration and just ignore the reality that there are a lot of people here unlawfully. So how did we get into this situation? Basically, we got into this situation because our laws are, in my mind and in my experience, out of touch with our economy. Immigration is mostly defined, it's mostly a result of economic interest. And economic pushes out of a country and pulls into another country.
Mm-hmm.
That's not just in the United States, but anywhere in the world and anywhere in history.
Yeah, the push-pull phenomenon is really everywhere in the world, especially
right.
In Europe and Turkey and elsewhere.
Anywhere you look, you can pretty well explain why do people leave a country? Well, they're probably they're fleeing something. They're fleeing poverty, they're fleeing conflict, they're fleeing environmental degradation. And how do they decide where to go? Well, they go to where they have the opposite thing, where they have jobs available that will pay them, enough to survive on, where they have freedom, where they have where they can be reunited to family if what was missing was a relationship. So we see that happening, but our immigration laws in the United States, and this is, I think, kind of the fundamental missing piece for a lot of people who presume that our immigration laws in 2011 are something like what they were, in the 1850s when my ancestors came to this country. At that time, when my ancestors came from Holland, they came the legal way. But the reason they came the legal way was not because they were necessarily morally superior to the immigrants coming today. They came the legal way because there was absolutely no illegal way to immigrate to the United States in the 1850s because there was no federal immigration law.
If I just pause on that, that was a head-turner for me. The level of obstacles, legal obstacles today compared to when your parents came is like night and day.
It's a completely different ballgame. So basically, to summarize what our laws look like today, there's basically four ways you could come as an immigrant to the United States. So there's some other ways you might come temporarily as a visitor, but if your intention is to stay, you've got four basic paths. One is family-based. So if you have a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident who can file the petition, a petition on your behalf, you know, who is a spouse or a child or in some cases a parent or a sibling, a citizen, they might be able to bring you here. And the wait times will vary between, you know, very brief, like 6 months to a year if you're the spouse of a citizen, to as many as 23 years if you're the sibling of a citizen and you're in the Philippines. So that system works for some people, long wait times to be reunited, but if you happen to have the family petitioner, that might be an option. But there's a lot of people who want to immigrate who don't have a family petitioner. They don't have any relatives who have lawful status in the United States. So the next possibility would be employment-based immigration. Under the law, and this is the law we've had in one form or another since about 1965 with amendments, but that's when we really got the backbone of our current law. If an employer sponsors you and they can prove that there's no U.S. citizen willing to do your job, there's 140,000 visas available per year for employment-based immigrants. But the trick with that figure is all but 5,000 have to go to highly skilled immigrants. So in a given year, at most, 5,000 low-skilled immigrants could be sponsored by an employer. The trick with that is there's a lot more jobs that don't require a master's degree that immigrants are happy to do and most American citizens are not eager to do, especially in fields like agriculture and hospitality industries. So we have a very low number of visas. You know, just to put that number in context, 100 years ago, 5,000 immigrants could come through Ellis Island in a single day. And they, you know, most of them, if we had the same classification system that we have today, would be considered low-skilled. Today, that's how many employment-sponsored immigrants we allow in a year who are low-skilled.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously a huge bottleneck. And the other two ways people might come is if they win a lottery called the Diversity Lottery. Your odds of winning are about 1 in 300. And there's no visa lottery for Mexico or the Philippines, China, India.
Right, it's selective.
It's only the countries that don't send a lot of immigrants. And then the final way is if you're fleeing persecution for very specific reasons, not fleeing poverty, not fleeing a natural disaster, but if you're fleeing actual persecution because of your race or your religion, your political opinion, your social group, your national origin, you might be considered as a refugee, or you might be granted asylum if you got to the United States.
Isn't the standard for proving that pretty high?
The standard for proving that is very high. And it's also true that, you know, we resettle into the United States about 80,000 refugees per year in recent years, maybe 70,000 last year, which on one level is very generous compared to other countries, the most that any country allows, but it's still less than 0.5% of the overall refugee population in the world. So the fact that you are fleeing persecution does not mean you've got a golden ticket to come to the United States.
Well, just to remind our audience, we're talking to Mr. Matthew Sorens, who's co-author of a book, Welcoming the Stranger. He'll be here next Sunday, Champaign Public Library, to be talking about the issue of immigration in the United States. His talk is entitled Welcoming the Stranger. And this will be, refresh my memory, 3 o'clock, is it, Sunday afternoon?
3 o'clock in the afternoon.
At the Champaign Public Library. And the topic of our conversation this afternoon is immigration. And the subtitle of your book is seems to me to be, capture what we want to discuss, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. And if you're interested in talking with Mr. Sorens from World Relief about this topic, you can call in locally at 333-9455. We also have an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, you mention a historian named Roger Daniels, and you reference his observation that Americans tend to hold what he calls a dualistic opinion about immigration. What is that about?
Well, I think what Dr. Daniels is getting at, and I've certainly observed as well, even in perhaps in my own life, is that many Americans have a real regard for the idea of immigration. We recognize that, you know, with the exception of Native Americans, who I think sometimes get left out of this debate in an unfortunate way, most of us have an immigrant history. You know, whether that was like my ancestors, they came you know, 150 or 200 years ago, or they came even before that. You know, they came on the Mayflower or on a slave ship from Africa, or if they came last week, or through Ellis Island, or, you know, whenever they came, we have, most of us know a little bit. We usually don't know much, but we know a little bit about our own ancestors' journey to the United States, and we tend to think positively of them. We think of them as being very courageous people who, you know, were very innovative and entrepreneurial and pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. And sometimes I think we presume that they learned English the day they got off the boat. Mm. You know, we think very highly of them. And of course, we're very quick to say, and they came the legal way. Again, often unaware of how different the legal way is today from how it was when most of our ancestors came. But then if you ask Americans about immigrants who are coming today, the opinions are more mixed. Some people are still very supportive of immigrants, for sure, but many people have very negative feelings towards immigrants. They feel that these immigrants don't want to assimilate into society, these immigrants don't learn English, you know, these immigrants, as opposed to the ones who made this country great, are destroying our economy or committing crimes. You know, we tend to think that these are immigrants today are very different than the immigrants of 100 years ago or 200 years ago, when in reality, the response to immigration in the United States has always had that sense of mixed messages. You've always had a few people who were standing up for immigrants, but you've also always had people going back to the very beginning of our country and even before we were a nation who thought that immigrants were a threat, that they weren't going to integrate into society, that there were going to be negative economic consequences of migration.
Yeah, you mentioned Ben Franklin.
Yeah, if you go back to Ben Franklin, you know, way, you know, before this was a nation, so we're going way back, you know, he said his concern was not, you know, his concern was the Germans coming into Pennsylvania, which is, you know, funny. In fact, he said, I'll can read this. He says, why should the Germans establish their language and manners to the exclusion of ours? Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to change us instead of our Anglifying them, and will never adopt our language or customs any more than they can acquire our complexion?
Who would have thought that Newt Gingrich is a contemporary reincarnation of Ben Franklin?
Well, it is funny that you could think of many people in our society, especially some media and political personalities, who would say things very similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
They probably wouldn't mention complexion and color of skin today because that would be, you know, politically incorrect. But it's almost humorous that, you know, Benjamin Franklin thought that a German person could never change their complexion to resemble a British person. Well, to be honest, I couldn't. I don't think I, as a Caucasian American, I don't think I could look at a German person and a British person and tell the difference. But that was such a chasm for Mr. Franklin. And, of course, the Germans did assimilate and integrate into society, and so did the Italians, and so did, you know, the Irish, and so did the Polish, and so did the Jewish. But there's a lot of people who think, well, these new immigrants are different. And the data does not bear that out, but oftentimes people are basing their opinions on isolated circumstances and isolated anecdotal experiences, the same way that 100 years ago the immigrants who'd arrived two generations previously were doing about, you know, the Italians and the Poles and the Jews who are coming through Ellis Island.
Well, you mentioned the push-pull problem earlier. And there's a passage, I think I wrote down your words, as long as the pull of employment in the U.S. matches the push of economic hardship in other countries, migration will not stop, no matter how challenging and hazardous we make the process for entry. I was just reminded earlier today I heard Republican presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann announced that her solution to the immigration problem was to complete the wall from the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico, which clearly is not going to solve the problem, as you say. But I guess my question is, this push-pull problem certainly has been the history in this country, but hasn't that changed since the recession? I have seen anecdotal examples of some, particularly Mexicans, who have been unable to find jobs, and they've gone back to Mexico.
No, that's absolutely true. And it's really the best way to stop illegal immigration is to wreck our economy.
Right.
I don't know that that's something we want to do.
Right.
But it works a lot better than a wall. We've poured, you know, billions of dollars into border security over the last decade, both under President Bush and under President Obama, increasing that amount, you know, every year. And it didn't really work until the economy went bad, and then something worked. And, of course, mm-hmm. proponents of walls will say, well, look how successful this is. Economists will tell you, well, it probably has a lot more to do with, you know, a really rough economy in the United States and also a growing economy over the last decade, kind of quietly. Mexican economy has not done too badly.
Right. There's a middle class that's growing in Mexico.
There is. And that's a really positive thing, not the terrible economy in the U.S., but a growing economy in Mexico. And it points, I think, to the long term. You know, we talk at World Relief, we talk about comprehensive immigration reform. If we wanted to be truly comprehensive, we'd have to address the economic situations in the countries that immigrants come from. Because that is the ultimate, I mean, that's the ultimate solution is for people in Mexico not to feel so desperately poor that they can't feed their families without moving.
Mm-hmm.
But in the short term, with that process, you know, I'm not brilliant enough to tell you the solution to global poverty, but I think we do need to look at, as we think about immigration policies, we need to let those push and pull factors inform the way we think. And I'm not against border security. I think it actually needs to be a part of how we address this issue. But if we only do border security, you know, you can build a wall. The joke I've heard people say is the solution to a 12-foot wall is a 13-foot ladder.
Right.
Really, a wall is not the best technology that we could come up with, even if our goal is to keep people from entering unlawfully, which I think is a fair goal. But I think if we're going to stop people from entering unlawfully and we don't want to wreck our economy, we need to think about letting people enter legally and have a reasonable system for how we do that. A lot of people think that system already exists, that people just need to go back and come the legal way. And the reality, if you study the immigration laws, is our system does not work that way. There's not a legal way for most people to come. There's no line for them to wait in. It doesn't matter if they wait 5 years or 15 years or 50 years, they'll never be able to enter lawfully. And if when they come here there's no job for them, then that might be no problem. The problem is we do have jobs for them. Even in a rough economy, there are some jobs that, especially I'm thinking of in agriculture, that most American citizens are not willing to do, that many immigrants are willing to do. And we're seeing this in places like Alabama and Georgia, where state-level laws have made it very difficult for undocumented immigrants. And growers in those states are complaining quite loudly that, you know, they cannot find adequate workers. Even though unemployment is 9 or 10 or 11%, the people who are unemployed don't want to do that agricultural work. And as long as we have those jobs available, but we don't make visas available, illegal immigration will happen, no matter how hard we make it for people to enter.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, and it's, frankly, not that we want illegal immigration to happen, but as consumers, we want immigration to happen if we enjoy that, you know, quality, low-cost produce. And the many other ways that immigrants contribute to our economy and allow us to have the standard of living that we enjoy.
I take it from your recommendations at the end of your book that what you're advocating is the best solution is intelligent and compassionate revisiting of our laws.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we do a lot of ministry at World Relief to immigrants on a one-to-one level, and we think that's incredibly important. But I'm constantly running into situations in my neighborhood and in my work where I can't really help someone. Because what they need is a Social Security number, and I can't give that to them.
Mm-hmm.
What they need is a job to support their families, and they may have that, but they may sometimes be being paid, you know, less than the minimum wage, or you know, being forced to work in unsafe conditions, separated from their families who are back in another country in some cases. I can't change those things for them. And that's why I think both for the case of immigrants, but also for our national security, for our national economy, we need a reform of our immigration laws. That is smart, that is just, that honors the rule of law, that we're not saying, you know, the law didn't matter, we're just going to pretend it didn't exist, here's amnesty. That's not what we're advocating. But we do think that there needs to be ways for people to get right with the government, to get right with the law, paying a fine if appropriate for having violated the law, and then get on a path towards citizenship and integration in our society.
Well, I think it'd be helpful for a lot of people to read some of your stories. You tell quite a few stories, anecdotes, that I'm sure you and your co-author thought were the best way to communicate just how it is that people show up here with the best of intentions and then suddenly find themselves, quote-unquote, illegal.
Right.
And your proposal is to, instead of making sure that stamp of illegal is emblazoned to their foreheads, to try to develop an intelligent. I mean, after all, they were they didn't sneak in. It is so much as they were drawn in for economic reasons, and that points to all of the complexities that you're talking about. And your proposal is to develop a process by which they can become legal.
Right. I mean, I think so. It's a multi-faceted response, and it's something that I would also note is, you know, supported by a broad range of people. 72% of Americans, according to the Pew Forum survey, like this plan, including a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats. But basically, the proposal that we've supported is one of comprehensive immigration reform. And that would basically say, yes, border security make it harder to enter illegally, harder to work illegally, but at the same time make it easier to enter and to work lawfully, not without limit, but to meet the needs of the U.S. economy. Have some smart economists figure out how many visas that is, and also to keep families together. We don't think that you should be separating, you know, kids from their parents. And then the tough question, perhaps, is what do we do with the immigrants here unlawfully, those 10.8 million people? And what we've said is, you know, we think a middle ground solution is the best. We don't think we should deport everyone, because for one thing, that creates a humanitarian crisis where there's about 2 million mixed status families. So you deport one member of the family, but you can't deport their U.S. citizen spouse or their U.S. citizen kids. And on the other hand, it's extremely expensive, and we don't have the money to spend between $80 billion to $200 billion just to physically round everyone up and get them out of the country.
Right.
So we don't like that idea. On the other hand, we've been very clear at World Relief, though sometimes we get, you know, we get this term used against us. We don't think amnesty is a good idea. Amnesty defined as the dictionary does, which is, you know, forgiving and forgetting an offense. We think that it is really important that we recognize that people have violated the law. We understand the circumstances of it, but they still broke the law, either by entering unlawfully or by overstaying a visa. And we think it's appropriate that instead of just giving amnesty and saying, here's your free pass, that there's some penalties involved. So we think, you know, a monetary penalty, you do a background check, and if people have committed crimes, which a few of them have, most have not, if they have committed serious crimes, then you do get deported. But for the vast majority who have just been here to work and to support their families, they would be eligible to get a probationary legal status during, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 years when they can show that they're here to work, to pay their taxes, to support their families, and to stay out of trouble. And if at the end of that time they can show that they've done those things and that they're working on paying English or on learning English, they'd be eligible for lawful permanent residence, which is a green card.
We do have a caller here for you on line one. Good afternoon. You're on Keeping the Faith. Do you have a question or comment?
Goodness. It seems that we have both a northern and a southern border, and an eastern and a western. When are we going to erect walls and fences around all of the states? I'm rather not in favor of a Berlin Wall or an Iron Curtain, but we've got a good start on it. And rather than spend the money on our drone sightseers or planes which can be used against installations in the states. I mean, the radio technology on it can't be all that complicated. Why don't we just go to the trouble of building at appropriate entry places, hostels, places for people to come in, register saying that, yes, I'd like to work, and can you assign me a work permit number and a place for me to... Gee, it was really hard coming 800 or so miles up here. I'm dirty, I'm hungry. And if there's somebody who really needs me, like the Clintons when they needed workers for their poultry cleaning operations, I can think of a few other things, like the cleanup of the Kalamazoo River, which is still not completed, which used braceros last year. If this work is available, and we really need to hire good transportation, fine, have it done at the employer's expense, and simply have our entries and leaving places simply being employment bureaus.
Well, I think that that's actually a wise idea. I think that if we made legal immigration more accessible to meet the needs of our economy, then we wouldn't have a problem with illegal immigration.
Now, why are we wasting all this wonderful money on people who are simply hell-bent on shooting up people and saying, you're nasty, you shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we could spend our resources much better, and at a time when we don't have a lot of resources to go around, I think that we could come up with better ways to do this. And the first way is, again, I'm not saying just ignore illegal immigration, but I think if we make the legal immigration process reasonable and fit it to the needs of our market economy, then I don't think we have nearly the problem with illegal immigration that we do currently.
Just to remind our listeners, this is a call-in show, and we are talking this afternoon about the topic of immigration to Mr. Matthew Sorens, who works with an organization called World Relief. He's written a book entitled Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, and he'll be here this coming Sunday afternoon at the Champaign Public Library to talk about these issues. And if you'd like to call in to ask a question of Mr. Sorens, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yep, you've got it.
Thank you. You can call in at 333-9455, or an 800 number is 1-800-222-9455. You spend a great deal of time in your book speaking with your fellow Christians, and use several biblical references. I was particularly struck by one, Exodus 23:9, which reads, quote, "Do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be an alien because you were aliens in Egypt." I guess I would have difficulty understanding how a Christian who takes a hardline attitude towards undocumented immigrants wouldn't feel less than convicted by that quotation. So I'm just curious,
right? Well,
how you deal with people who hear that language.
Right. I mean, I guess I think that, you know, I read that passage, and there's similar passages elsewhere in
right.
the Hebrew Scriptures that, you know, God repeatedly reminds the Israelites that they were themselves immigrants in Egypt, and they weren't treated well. They were foreigners in Egypt for 400 years, and eventually were basically enslaved.
Well, early on they were, right?
Right. Well, early on they were welcomed by
right.
by Pharaoh. In fact, when it was Joseph, who was sold into slavery as by his brothers, but eventually rose up to be the second highest leader in Egypt. And that Pharaoh recognized, wow, this immigrant, he's smart. He has a lot to bring to our society. And he saw immigration as an opportunity. Justo Gonzalez, who's a theologian, a Christian theologian, suggests that, you know, maybe that's the attitude we need to have now, is seeing immigration, seeing immigrants, as an opportunity. But you have that first Pharaoh in the end of Genesis, but you proceed to the beginning of Exodus, and you have a Pharaoh who saw immigrants as anything but an opportunity. He saw them as a threat. He said, there's too many of these people. You know, he has these national security concerns, and that echoes some of what we hear today. And his response was to just cut off certain people. He said, we're going to kill all the Hebrew babies, male children. And Moses, the hero of the Hebrew faith, was born into that context, and like any good parent, his parents didn't just comply. They tried to find their way around the law, and it didn't turn out very well for Pharaoh. If you read through the book of Exodus, he ends up, you know, his armies are drowned in the Red Sea. And I think, and then God gets his people into the Promised Land, and he tells them, don't forget what it was like to be immigrants, because you're going to have immigrants who come to you.
Right.
And you have to do better. And of course, as Americans, you know, as an American Christian, I feel like this should speak to me on a couple of levels, as, you know, learning the lesson of the Israelites, but also remembering that I have an immigrant history, and that when my ancestors came here, not everybody liked them either. And they faced a lot of, although the legal system was much more friendly, they still faced a lot of the same prejudice and discrimination from the people who were already here.
Well, you have started a conversation here, Mr. Sorens. We have three callers. We have a caller here on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith, line one. You have a question or comment for Mr. Sorens.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling a few minutes ago. Mr. Sorens mentioned that he thought that the immigrants who are coming in should be stating that they're intending on the process of learning English. And I was wondering why that's an issue, given our national language is not English. We have a rich history of our immigrants, where the Germans that came in, some of the Irish, many of the southern and central Europeans weren't speaking English when they came in. Nobody forced them to, but is part of coming to be a part of our civic culture. They did learn the language eventually without anyone forcing them to, and why we shouldn't extend the same courtesy to Central American and South American immigrants that we're seeing today.
Yeah, that's a good question, and you're right. I mean, most immigrants, almost all immigrants, learn English within a generation. Often, and that's been the case historically in the United States. If you look at second-generation Hispanic immigrants in the U.S. today, the vast majority of them speak English fluently and as their first language. In fact, by the third generation, they've often lost Spanish or whatever the first language, their parents' language was. I think, you know, and I also, you know, English is a big deal for a lot of people in this debate. I found that that's often, you know, one of a real tension point for a lot of people, that for whatever reason. I think it is true that most immigrants will learn English on their own without a law telling them they have to, and that most want to learn English. I've never met an immigrant who said, well, I don't want to learn English. They usually say, I want to learn English. I know it would help me with my job. It would help me to fit in. But it's hard. And anyone who's 45 years old and hasn't ever learned another language and starts trying will be able to affirm to you that our brains, God did not make our brains to adapt to a new language very easily at that age. That said, I think, you know, part of this is a political compromise, too, in that we need to find legislation that will work. And since immigrants want to learn English anyway, if it can help pass a reasonable set of reforms to say, we want you to show that you're learning English, I don't have a problem with that.
We also have a caller on line two. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment for Mr. Sorens?
Yeah, there's a couple of really basic questions, and then there's one fallacy that I keep hearing to this. The first is the fallacy. I keep hearing that there's all these jobs that Americans won't take. And I've got a brother-in-law. He cleans out septic tanks for a living. I don't think there's any job an American won't take. I think there's a lot of jobs Americans won't take cheap. And I think there's a lot of jobs that Americans won't take with substandard working conditions or abusive bosses or a lot of other things. But I don't think there's a job an American won't take. The next thing that I kind of wonder about is, when are we full? At what point do we say, if I move my elbow, you have to move, and we're full and nobody else can come? I think we've already reached that point. In 1986, the U.S. government decided we were full. They stopped the homesteading program. They said, there's no more land. That's it. We're done. We're full. So I would suggest at this point, any other immigrants coming are just elbowing somebody else aside. You know, I'm sorry. We're full. I'm sorry. We don't need them, but we don't. So, you know, it kind of works like that. The last comment is that you hear quite often about, we have to bring in immigrants to do American jobs that Americans are not qualified for or don't want to do. In the trucking industry, I'm familiar with that. There's a company near me that has managed to do this. And the reason they can't find truck drivers is because they pay 18 cents a mile. The industry standard's about three times that. If there really is that, I would propose that the way to handle that situation is to say, as a company, you can bring in people to do any job you want them to do. But as a company, you also have to come up with a plan to educate American workers to do that job and to bring those people in to your company to replace the immigrants that will be sent back at the end of that period. And those are my three major points.
Well, thank you for your points,
Mr.
Sorens.
Those are helpful. Let me see if I can address each of them. You know, to the question of are there jobs that Americans will not do? And at, you know, I guess probably it is a question of pay at a certain level. You know, if we were willing to pay $30 an hour for agricultural work, maybe we could find more people to do it. But actually, those jobs would just leave the United States then. We wouldn't have any agriculture in the United States because most people would not, you know, we couldn't compete with other countries doing agricultural work. And that becomes a food security issue as well. I heard someone say recently, you know, if you think foreign oil is a problem, wait till we have foreign food. And we don't produce any food that's in the United States. So I think it is really important that we do keep some agriculture here at home. And most Americans at current wages, and agriculture work is actually not a minimum wage job in many parts of the country. Many parts of the country, they're paying $10, $12 an hour. But even still, you'll have, I mean, there have been many reports out of Alabama and Georgia in the last few weeks with their state-level laws. You will have a few American citizens apply for jobs, and they don't last very long out in the fields, and they go and find other work or find another opportunity. Now, then there's the question of, I do agree, though, that we need to ensure that the companies are paying people fairly and that work, you know, that labor laws are enforced. That's part of why I think we need a process to really raise the floor. If the problem with immigrants is not that they're here and working, it's that they're here unlawfully, so they're open to being exploited. And then they can undercut U.S. citizen workers, which is why, again, I don't think illegal immigration is a good thing. I think we don't want undocumented immigrants in this country. But the solution is not to get rid of them by sending them back. It's by making them documented workers who can, then you have to compete on a fair level with U.S. citizens.
We also have a caller on line four. Thank you for patiently waiting on line four. You have a question or comment for Mr. Sorens.
Yes. My question is, I've been listening now for about the last half an hour or so, and I don't think, from my experience, I've never had the same experience that the author has had, because if you go into a place where there's a bunch of Mexicans working, and I'm about as white as can be, and I'm also a German and Irish, and I'll guarantee you, I cannot get a job in that Mexican outfit.
Well, you know, I haven't probably applied to the same place as you have, because I'm in a different part of the country. I guess I think it would be important, you know, I would take a step back, and instead of just looking at anecdotes, look at the bulk of economic evidence. And if you talk to, you know, almost any economist who, you know, are not liberal people usually, they're usually pretty conservative folks, 44 out of 46 economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal a few years back said that illegal immigration in particular has been good for the U.S. economy and good for the average American worker. There is some question amongst economists on whether immigration is good for all American workers. If there's anyone who is negatively affected, it's probably American-born workers who have a low level of education, who, you know, so a high school degree or less. But still, 3 out of 4 economists think that effect is there is no negative effect, or the effect is slight. And the positive effect is borne out.
Well, I'd like to see those economists you're talking about. I'd like to say, I worked in the pro-agriculture. I used to drive a truck hauling vegetables, and I guarantee you, I'll bring one of those experts out to the cooler and see if he can get a job.
Well, and I'm not disputing your experience, sir, but I think that there may be individual cases where immigration negatively affects some American workers, but the overall effect is decidedly positive if you look at it, you know, from a 30,000-foot perspective. When economists look at these things, they almost all find the exact same thing, which is that most Americans are benefited economically because of the arrival of immigrants in this country. That's been true historically, and it continues to be true. It's also true because if we don't have a growing population, which goes to the other caller's point, our Social Security system is in big trouble because it's built upon the supposition of a growing population.
On the other side of the coin now, my son had an illegal working with him a couple of years ago. And when Arizona instituted that thing, you know, if you're going to be a felon if we catch you, he was smart enough. He just headed back there. He says, now he says, I do not want to be a felon, and he left there. Now, how many illegals do you know that are worried about something like that?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who don't have legal status who are decidedly worried about, you know, what will happen to them and their families with the direction that politics goes and how we change policies, one way or the other.
But and they're, I think, still here, right?
Well, usually, for example, what's happened with Arizona or Alabama or Georgia, these other states that have done similar laws.
Well, they're not too worried about if they're still here, because Joaquin, he's been gone for 2 years. Now, he was very upset with the fact that he might be a felon, and he was one of the smartest, hardest-working guys, and he was hard working. He was a smart worker. And you don't get any fairer than that.
Right, and I would wonder if he left Arizona to go to Mexico or if he went to another state.
He went to Mexico.
Well, that may happen.
That's where he was from.
In some cases, that may happen. What we're seeing in most cases is people are leaving states because of these laws, to some degree. Most of them are not leaving the United States. They're going to a different state.
I just think that it's from the scenario that you're giving, that I've heard, is these are people are not, they're not working, or they haven't been where the rubber meets the road.
Well, I think it's worth looking. I think it's the statistics actually are all pretty consistent, but that doesn't mean there aren't isolated, cases where some people may be negatively affected. I also want to be clear, we're not saying we should allow unlimited immigration. We're saying let's figure out what is the sweet spot of the number of jobs that our economy needs to keep moving. And the Chamber of Commerce and other business-focused groups have been very clear that they don't have adequate labor to continue growing. And if we want to have a growing economy, we need more lawful migration.
Yeah, I agree with your outline of the possible solutions that you've mentioned. I agree with a lot of them, but I think I agree with them, and I'm coming from a different reason, because just like Joaquin, when he hit the road, it was just too bad that he couldn't get in here legally, because he was a smart person, he was a hard-working person, he could do things, he could work for the best of us, mm-hmm. and he took care of his family and all that stuff, but he did not want to be a felon, and I think that a lot of the people that I'd be happy to be proved wrong with this point. I'd like to see them. I'd like to see the point. Let's go out in the field, or let's go to a place where they hire Mexicans or Irishmen or anybody else that's here illegally, and say, "Are you worried about being caught?"
Well, sir, thank you for your call. We're getting close to the end of the program here, and let's try to wind up a little bit here. Could I give you just a couple of questions here before we wind up?
Sure.
You talk about the ethical issue of disobeying immoral laws. Just a quickie here. We don't have a whole lot of time here, but let me ask you, how would you counsel a Christian pastor or parishioner in Georgia or Alabama today, which have instituted, or Arizona for that matter, pretty draconian laws, whose churches are considering harboring undocumented immigrant families?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't give specific advice, I guess, on that point.
Right.
But I think I would challenge them to think biblically. A lot of Christians will go to Romans 13, where it says, the Apostle Paul says that we should be subject to the governing authorities. And I think that's absolutely true in general. But there may be times when it also says in Acts 5:29, when Peter is preaching the gospel and the authorities tell him he has to stop, he says, well, we must obey God rather than men. I have a friend who's a youth pastor in Phoenix, and it is now against the law for him to bring his church van to pick people up for church. And he has decided that he thinks the call that God has put on his life, minister to these youth, who many of whom are undocumented. I should say it's illegal to transport someone who is undocumented.
Sorry to interrupt you. We are just about out of time here. Let me just remind our listeners that we've been talking with Matthew Sorens, who's written a book entitled Welcoming the Stranger. He'll be here next Saturday. I'm sorry, Sunday at Champaign Public Library, talking about the immigration problem from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Thank you so much for being with us, and sorry we have to wind up quickly. It's a very interesting topic, and thank you for your contribution, Mr. Sorens. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all for being with Keeping the Faith. Look forward to hearing from you next week. Thank you. Good evening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
You may have heard us talk about the importance of our member match fund. Well, there's still time for you to help build the fund before the Power Hour begins on October 20th. because a successful Power Hour leads to a successful pledge drive. Mail a check today to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And thank you.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WIL.